Good afternoon, everybody. I think we'll get started so we can get you out of here on time. My name is Brian Paul. I'm a partner at Ice Miller, if we haven't met. And today's topic is judicial selection, and in particular, Indiana's method for judicial selection, although I expect that our speaker will talk more broadly about judicial selection around the country. I was recently asked whether I knew that our Chief Justice was retiring when I scheduled this talk, and the answer is no. I actually asked Professor Ware to speak on this topic back in September, and that was long before Justice Shepard announced his retirement, and I'm not privy to his timeline, so my timing just happens to be good. My wife would typically not agree with that, but this time it worked out. then more recently, I was asked, why invite a professor from Kansas to speak on Indiana judicial selection? And the main reason I had Professor Ware come out is because he came highly recommended. And he's an expert on the topic, but also I think it's simply good to hear the perspective of an outsider who really has no investment in our current system, and so I think that you can take him take his word that he is objective as he could be, and that his analysis is in good faith. Professor Ware is the author of two books, more than 30 law review articles, and many other publications. He's been on the faculty of KU since 2003. He's taught at several other law schools. He's a frequent speaker at academic conferences, CLEs, all that good stuff. And he's testified before Congress, state legislatures, and as an expert witness in court. He's appeared on several television and radio stations, and he's been quoted in major publications like the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, the National Law Journal. So please welcome Professor Steve Ware to present the case against Indiana's method of judicial selection.
Thank you. Thank you all. I want to just start by thanking Indianapolis Federalist Society and Brian Paul in particular for inviting me and setting this up, and thank all of you for taking time out of your busy lives to be here. The first thing I need to make sure is that I am being heard, if I'm being loud enough. So I'm going to ask the folks kind of in the back, if you could just raise your hand if you can hear me fine. I'll know if you're not raising your hand that you're not hearing my request. Thank you. I thought the first thing I should do is give a little introduction of why me and this topic, picking up on some of the things Brian said. I do think what I bring to this topic is a national perspective on how the 50 states select their judges. As you may be able to tell from my accent, I grew up in New York, and I went to Chicago for law school, then practiced law in New York City, but went to Birmingham, Alabama to become a law professor at Cumberland School of Law. Lived in Alabama for 10 years and then moved to Kansas for my current job. So I've lived under several different judicial systems as an adult who's interested in law, thinking about how the judges are selected in these different states. And I've sort of kept up this national perspective by traveling around the country and giving talks like this and asking the lawyers and others in a particular state sort of how things are working, so I get some perspective on sort of facts on the ground in addition to what's publicly available to be read. And I hope that that can continue today. In other words, I'm eager to hear what you all have to say that you think bears on this topic, and it'll help me to sort of collect more and more evidence about how things work in different places. So the national perspective, I think, is one important thing I bring to this topic. And then the other thing I think I bring to this topic is just my job as a law professor gives me the luxury of time to research and write. And I started this process of writing and researching on judicial selection back in the 1990s when I lived in Alabama. Some of you may know that Alabama has elections, partisan elections, Republicans against Democrats, for its state Supreme Court, and had some pretty controversial, high-profile election campaigns during that era, the 1990s. So that got me interested in judicial selection. I was reading about it in the newspaper every morning, so I figured, hey, I'm a law professor. I have time to research. I'm going to dig down and do the deeper research beyond what a newspaper reporter can do. And I've pretty consistently since then stayed with the topic of judicial selection in my research and writing, particularly the last 3 or 4 years. I've devoted a lot of time and attention to the topic. So that's, I guess, a quick introduction of me. And before I go any further, I think it would be helpful if I got a sense of who you all are, just sort of quickly. Can you raise your hand if you're a lawyer? If you're a lawyer, please raise your hand. Lots of lawyers here. Raise your hand, please, if you're licensed to practice law in the state of Indiana. Almost everybody except for me who raised their hands the first time raised the second time. Judicial Nominating Commission. Anybody here a member, past, or present of the JNC in Indiana? No JNC. And how about judges? Any sitting or former judges? A few judges here. Terrific. Okay. What I want to do is give this sort of big picture of the 50 states. There's a lot of variety among the 50 states, but basically three ways judges are selected. The first one I've got up here, often called the Missouri Plan, is the sort of system Indiana has for its appellate courts, where when there's a vacancy on the court, people who want to fill that vacancy apply to the commission, and the commission narrows down the pool of applicants to typically three finalists, and then the governor picks one of those three. And then the second bullet point here, the second common method of judicial selection around the country is similar to what we have for federal judges, where the president nominates and the U.S. Senate votes to confirm or not that judge. Many states use an analogous system where the governor nominates, but then the state senate or similar popularly elected body votes whether or not to confirm that person on the bench. And then finally, third common method of judicial selection around the country is contestable judicial elections. Contestable meaning two or more candidates running for the seat, distinguished from retention elections, which Indiana and other states using the Missouri plan have. So retention elections belong up here with Missouri plan, as a judge who's already on the bench to stay on the bench wins retention, but that's not against any opposing candidate. That's a yes or no vote, retain or not the judge on the bench, as opposed to the third bullet point down there, what I described in Alabama, for example, where two or more candidates are running for a position, much like we'd see for governor or Congress or whatever. And those contestable judicial elections, if you want to sort of further subdivide the states, some states have partisan elections like I described in Alabama. Other states have nonpartisan elections for Supreme Court, but still contestable in the sense that more than one candidate can run. And it, frankly, it varies how truly nonpartisan those states are. Sometimes it's more nonpartisan in name than in reality. Yes, sir?
In the middle bullet point there, when the term runs out, are they appointed for life? When the term runs out, they reappoint, or what happens?
Terrific question. When the term runs out, what happens in the middle bullet point here, what I'll call the Senate confirmation system, because, of course, at the federal level, there is no term runs out. It's life tenure. And so what this really very good question brings up is the hugely important distinction between judicial selection and judicial retention. In other words, what initially puts a judge on the court? That's one important question. A separate important question is how does the judge stay on the court, if the judge wants to? Judicial retention is something I hope to get to in detail later in my talk, but just to quickly answer that question, some states with the Senate confirmation system have what's effectively life tenure, a mandatory retirement age, so it looks very similar to the federal system. Other states with that Senate confirmation system do have terms that are short enough that a judge might well want another term, and often goes back through the same process that initially put the judge on the court. Terrific point to highlight this distinction between initial selection of a judge and then retention, how a judge stays on the court. And it helps me sort of announce my organization of this talk to everybody, which is I do plan to focus on initial selection for the bulk of my talk and then return to the retention topic at the end of the talk. But I do think they're importantly separate issues. Okay. It's, I think, worth noting, since we're in Indiana and I'm asking you to have an open mind to rethinking Indiana's system, to point out that all three of these systems have, at one time in Indiana's history, been in place. Right now we have in Indiana for the appellate courts and I think two trial courts, the Missouri plan kind of system. However, in Indiana's early years, state Supreme Court was selected under what I call the federal model, the Senate confirmation system. If my notes are right, 1816 to 1851, Indiana had that system for its highest court. And then in 1851, all the way up to 1970, over a century, contestable judicial elections. So importantly, I think Indiana's trajectory, if we can call it that, is typical of what we see nationwide. In other words, the Senate confirmation system or federal model, that was most widely used in the early days of our country. And then the standard story is Jacksonian democracy in the early to mid-1800s. Popular democracy causes the movement to judicial elections, contestable judicial elections. And then in the 20th century, the Missouri plan is typically traced to the progressive era, the early 20th century progressive movement, sort of the intellectual origins of the Missouri plan, although it wasn't actually adopted in the states that use it until a generation or two later. So Indiana, 1970, going to the Missouri plan, you might think of the 60s and 70s as sort of the second progressive era, right? There's that early progressive era and then another big wave of, you might say, liberal reform in the 60s and 70s, adopting the Missouri plan, not just in Indiana, but in a few other states as well. Yes, sir?
In 1970, prior to 1970, the candidates not only were partisan, but they were selected, as many of our other statewide candidates are, at state-nominated conventions. Do you know when that arose within the contestable period? Was it always that way from 1851 to 1970, or did that come in later?
That's a good question. I don't know Indiana in particular, and it raises a really good point nationwide, which is contestable judicial elections. Okay, maybe we're going to see two names on the ballot at the general election, but how did those two names get there, right? That's an important question. And in fact, one I hope to get, I'm going to get a slide in a little while that touches on that a little more detail. So I'm sorry, I don't know the answer for Indiana in particular. Okay. So now what I'd like to do is start assessing these three methods of judicial selection. And in assessing these three, I like to start with what I think is a hugely important point that is often ignored in public discussion of judicial selection. And that hugely important point is judges make law. For example, judges make the common law. We lawyers all know that, right? This has been going on for centuries back to England. Lots of issues come up in court where there's no statute or regulation right on point, but yet there's parties with a dispute. Judge has to rule one way or the other. In the course of doing so, judge inevitably makes law. This is not just historical. Still today, many important areas of law, primarily common law, contracts, torts, generally common law areas, judge made law. Been going on for centuries. Nothing too controversial, I don't think, about that. The Anglo-American common law, basically a good conservative, traditional sort of thing. Judge made law. Common law, though, not the only area in which judges make law. Before I go on to that, though, I do want to say something about the common law that I think is important, which is some, not all, but some important aspects of the common law are predictably political. And by predictably political, I mean liberal judges and conservative judges tend to differ from each other in predictable ways. Example would be tort reform kind of issues. Another example would be unconscionable contracts, what contracts not to enforce. These are examples of common law doctrines where liberal and conservative judges differ from each other in predictable ways. Same is true with another area of lawmaking by judges. Common law, not the only area. Also, if you think about statutory cases, constitutional cases, the language of statutes and constitutions doesn't always dictate a clear result. There's often vague or ambiguous language in statutory or constitutional provisions, so it inevitably falls to the judge to interpret the language of the statute or constitution, and there's some discretion there for the judge, more than one reasonable answer. And in exercising that discretion, again, judges inevitably make law. Judges make law not just in common law cases, but in the process of interpreting statutes and constitutions. And here again, it's sometimes predictably political. Liberal conservative judges predictably differing on which sorts of statutes or constitutional provisions to interpret broadly or narrowly. An example of that that's been documented empirically would be employment discrimination statutes. So not only do judges make law, different judges play different roles in the lawmaking process. Common law, as we've all known since Erie versus Tompkins, primarily made by state rather than federal courts. There's an important area of judicial lawmaking that state court judges do and federal court judges don't do much of. And then also, where in the system is a judge? The highest judge in the system, the Supreme Court justice, has more lawmaking role than lower court judges, simply because Supreme Courts, higher courts, can overrule de novo the legal rulings of lower courts. So I submit to you that this shows that the lawmaking role of a judge is biggest for state Supreme Court justices. State Supreme Court justices, I submit to you, do lawmaking, legitimately so, more than other judges, more than lower court judges, and because of the common law point, more than federal judges. I think everything I've said to this point is just fact, not my opinion. I don't think I've expressed my opinion on anything yet. I think everything I've said is just description of reality. But now I am going to express and opinions. My opinion is that in a democratic society like ours, lawmakers should be selected democratically. Now, I don't think this should be a controversial opinion. Of course, in a democracy, lawmakers should be selected democratically, but many lawyers disagree. Many lawyers support the Missouri plan, even though it's quite undemocratic. This is really the core, the heart of my presentation, so I want to just kind of stop here and have this sink in. I don't think you can reconcile the Missouri plan with the proposition that in a democratic society like ours, lawmakers should be selected democratically. I think if you buy this premise, you have to reject the Missouri plan. But let's drill down a little bit into Indiana's system as an example to try to see that, using the Indiana Supreme Court, because like I said, I think the case about judges being lawmakers really sort of most relevant, most important with a state Supreme Court. Indiana's process, typical Missouri plan process, where there's applications to fill a vacancy, judicial nominating commission narrows the pool down to some finalists, and the governor has to pick one of those finalists. Now, this is really the importance of the commission. The nominating commission, if you think about it, the judicial nominating commission, it's the gatekeeper to the state Supreme Court. Nobody can get on that court unless they get through the commission. It's true the governor gets to elect among those three, but Boss Tweed, the boss of the Tammany Hall political machine in New York, he'd say, well, I don't care who the governor is. I don't care who the governor is, gets to elect among those three, so long as the boss gets to do the nominating of who are the three the governor has to choose from, right? So in this sense, the Judicial Nominating Commission is sort of like the boss, getting to do the nominating, and then the governor picks one of those three. Hugely important who's on that judicial nominating commission. Boss Tweed knew it. We all know it. So let's see how it works in Indiana. This is a diagram of how the judicial nominating commission is selected. Seven members. The one in the middle is the Chief Justice. I'll leave aside for now. These three members of the commission, perfectly democratic process in selecting them, because all the people in Indiana get to vote for the governor, and the governor picks those three commissioners. The departure, the violation of democratic principles, comes in the selection of the other three commissioners. These folks are elected in elections open only to about 14,000 people in the state. Lawyers licensed to practice in Indiana get to vote for these commissioners. Everybody else in Indiana does not. Plainly inconsistent with the principle of one person, one vote. Plainly inconsistent with that basic idea of democratic equality. We have in Indiana first-class citizens and second-class citizens. I think that's all we need to know to reject this system. I think that's all we need to know to be upset about this system and to want to change it. Some of you will have different views, and I'm going to ask you to just hold them for a few minutes and express them in a few minutes. I'd like to just finish my presentation. I'm asking you all now to consider options for reforming this system. And I say this with nothing against lawyers. I'm a lawyer myself and proud of it. Shoot, my job as a law professor is to make more lawyers. Right? I think lawyers are great. I love lawyers. But Indiana lawyers are not superheroes. Don't deserve more political power than their fellow citizens. And that's what the Missouri plan, not just Indiana, but other states' Missouri plans do. I'm not just picking on Indiana. I've testified against similar systems in the legislatures of Iowa, Missouri, Kansas. Several Missouri plan states are considering reforming this system. So it's not just Indiana I'm making this point about. It's a general point. So I'm asking you to consider options for reforming this system. And if you are licensed to practice in the state of Indiana, I'm asking you to do something that's very hard, which is to put principle above self-interest, the principle of democratic equality above your own political power. That's what I'm asking you to do. Here are the reasons for reform, really two sides of the same coin, right? I'm suggesting we ought to restore democratic equality, one person, one vote, and I'm suggesting we ought to end the bar special power, two sides of the same coin. How can you do that? One way to do it is to reduce the number of bar-selected commissioners. I would reduce it to zero. That would solve the problem of violating the one-person, one-vote principle. Now, notice I don't say reduce the number of lawyers on the commission. Very different thing to say reduce the number of bar-selected commissioners. What violates that democratic principle of one person, one vote is not that there's lawyers on the commission. Great to have lawyers on the commission if you're going to have a commission. It's who selects those lawyers. That's the problem. Another option for reforming the system would be to keep the current system but add Senate confirmation on the back end. Governor's nominee doesn't go on the court unless the Senate confirms. Now, this wouldn't solve the violation of basic democratic equality, but it would greatly soften the impact of it. Because if the Senate says no, then the commission has to go back to the drawing board and find somebody new until they find somebody who is ultimately acceptable to popularly elected body, the state Senate. Notice that we don't have in Indiana that system right now with the governor playing that role, because the governor can't tell the commissioner to go back to the drawing board. The governor has to choose one of those three finalists the commission picks, or the governor's stuck with one of those three that the governor doesn't get to pick. I forget here, is it the Chief Justice who gets to pick? In some states it's the commission itself gets to pick, but that never happens. Governors always knuckle under to the commission's three finalists, and I use that language, knuckle under, to remind us of Matt Blunt, the governor of Missouri. Does anybody know this story? He publicly said, I don't like these three finalists. I don't want to pick among these three. But then somebody told him, if you don't, somebody else will, the commission will or the Chief Justice will. And he said, I got to pick the lesser of evils then, right? So adding Senate confirmation to the current system would really change the dynamics of it. It would make the commission much less powerful. Third option, just get rid of the commission and go to the federal model. Have a Senate-governor combination instead of a commission-governor combination. Select your appellate judges. And then fourth option would be contestable elections. My personal favorite of the three is number three. Excuse me, my personal favorite of the four is number three. Your own views I'll be interested to hear in a minute. I do want to, though, now return to that topic that the good question earlier brought up, which is the distinction between initial selection of a judge and then how a judge stays on the court, the retention. So I've got up in red across the top the three initial selection systems that are widely used around the country: contestable elections, Senate confirmation, Missouri plan. And then I've got over there, I guess that's the y-axis, the vertical up and down the left side there, the retention systems most widely used around the country. The non-renewable term, the extreme we talked about earlier, life tenure or a mandatory retirement age, is sort of one extreme of retention. What I'll call the judicial independence extreme. In other words, on retention, the real debate, everybody seems to agree, is judicial independence versus judicial accountability. Those are the two sort of marching slogans. And if you want judges accountable, if you want to keep judges on a short leash, contestable elections seem to be the approach most people go for there. You don't like what a judge is doing, you run a rival candidate that can run TV ads saying why to vote out the incumbent, and you vote out the incumbent and you elect the rival candidate. By contrast, life tenure, or another non-renewable term, very hard to remove a judge from the bench. You know, impeachment process, very rare, as I think it should be. And then sort of in between these two extremes, this would be the judicial accountability, this would be the judicial independence. In between the two is retention elections, which are obviously easier to remove a judge than life tenure, but not as easy to remove a judge as contestable election. Indiana, if my research is right, you've never, is it right, never had a judge lose a retention election? Now, maybe all the judges are 100% wonderful, and that's why. That's what lawyers in every state say. And certainly judges in every state say that's why the judges never lose. But, you know, it's not just Indiana. It's just about every state that has Missouri planned. The judges almost never lose retention elections. And if you look at how retention elections are set up, you don't have to be too cynical to conclude they're designed to produce that outcome. In other words, retention elections are designed to make it look like the public plays a role, but pretty hard to actually defeat somebody in a retention election, although it does happen. In fact, it just happened not long ago in Iowa. Many of you probably noticed three members of the Iowa Supreme Court lost retention. And those of us with gray hair probably remember Rose Byrd in California. So the retention elections do sometimes result. Penny White in Tennessee, a few judges, justices, lose retention elections around the country. But as I guess I already tipped my hand, on this choice of judicial accountability or judicial independence, I'm a judicial independence guy. My own preference is to be down here with mandatory retirement age, but effectively life tenure, or a very long term, 15, 20 year non-renewable term. And the crucial point is non-renewable, going back to that question earlier. If you make judges have to go back to the authority that appointed them to stay on the bench, then you really lose a lot of independence for the judiciary there. So I guess, I've tipped my hand that and when it comes to retention, I like the life tenure or close to it thing. I like the judicial independence thing. And here, as precedent, I would cite the framers of the U.S. Constitution and their reasoning in favor of judicial independence. And as I guess I said earlier also, when it comes to initial selection, I like what the framers of the U.S. Constitution did, the Senate confirmation system. So I think I'm a typical Federalist Society kind of guy in that I like the framers of the U.S. Constitution, what they did, and I think it has continuing relevance, lessons, wisdom for us today. I think we ought to follow it today. And with that, I will just try to tie this last point together about judicial independence and judicial retention. It's not just initial selection that I think the Missouri plan is flawed in Indiana and the other states that have the Missouri plan. Also, when it comes to the retention of judges, if you are, like me, a judicial independence sort of person, that's another reason to dislike the Missouri plan. It hasn't happened in Indiana yet, apparently, but Iowa's not that far away, not that different. It could happen, right? Judges being kicked out of office for reasons that we lawyers wouldn't like. So those are my views. I've asked you to be patient with yours, and I appreciate your patience, and now I'm very eager to hear what you have to say about all this. Thank you. Thank you very much.